The Tom Woods Show, episode 1937.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, you know as well as I do, the conventional wisdom is so often not just wrong, but catastrophically wrong. And if we don't challenge it, it will keep on doing damage. One such narrative, the claim that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008. That's totally false, and you should be able to smash that at a moment's notice. You can do so with my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman. Check it out at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Our friend Patrick Moore, one of the founders of Greenpeace, is back with us today. He's got a brand new book called Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. You just have to love the title. The book is outstanding. It's short. It's a quick read, but it is devastating in exposing example after example of things that haven't just been distorted, but have been invented out of whole cloth. It's unbelievable, really. Unbelievable, the kinds of things that we've been misled into believing about what's going on in the world and the environment. So Patrick Moore is going to do some correcting in this episode. Patrick, welcome back.
It's great to be back with you, Tom. What are we talking about today?
Well, of course, this book of yours, whose title I love, I've just told folks about it. I think I'm going to do something a little unorthodox in this episode, though. I think I'm not going to talk about climate change, simply because that's what everybody expects us to talk about. And I want to keep people on their toes when they listen to the old Tom Woods Show. And you are a multidimensional person, and I want to talk about a bunch of other things. I heard you on James Dellingpole's podcast, for example, and he was asking you about particular things from the environmental movement that you thought were meritorious or that had good results. And so you started talking about whales. And oh my gosh, you knew so much about whales. I've never seen you write anything about whales. And yet off the top of your head, you knew everything there was to know. So I thought, doggone it, I am not pigeonholing this guy exclusively in with climate change. Are you okay with that? Is that acceptable?
How refreshing, Tom.
Okay, good.
How refreshing.
Good, good, good. There are other... Now, I am going to suspend that rule ever so slightly because of one small thing. Rather than discuss climate change per se and what people are saying about it, there is one small thing I want to talk about. I did hear you talk about on the Dellingpole podcast, and I read it in your book. And you say that it's something that people kind of are figuring out and do generally know. But, you know, as a historian, I can tell you a lot of things we professional historians know, the general public does not know and will never find out. So I think that's also true about the polar bears. So what's been happening with the polar bears is the opposite of what the average person thinks. And the average person, by the way, walking through a science museum, let me just say, I'm sorry I'm talking too much, but I realized recently as I've been taking my kids through science museums, I'm not against science per se. It's absurd that I even have to point that out. I don't know anybody who's against science per se. But lately, it's like even the science museums, it's like they're propaganda factories or something. They can't just have a nice, cute science museum. It's always, you're a terrible person because look at all the damage you're doing. And maybe if we undo all your selfishness, we can't just have a science museum anymore. Have you noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, some people think this is actually the end of the Enlightenment, which was the period that began with Galileo and the realization that he was correct in suggesting that the Earth was not the center of the universe. And we've gone on all this time since then through the Enlightenment with science and technology and the discovery of all the elements and the understanding of gravity and the somewhat Einstein, Mendel, all the rest, Faraday, etc., Tesla, really unraveling the secrets of the universe. And now we come to a period where it is all garbage. The climate change issue, where they're saying that CO2 is too high and the temperature is too high, when in fact, it is the lowest temperature we've been in 250 million years since the last ice age. They don't realize we're in an ice age called the Pleistocene. It's easy to find out just by Googling Pleistocene ice age, and you'll find out that we're in it. An interglacial period, one of 40 or more, that have occurred in the last 2.6 million years. And then CO2 is actually at the lowest it's ever been in the history of the Earth. There have been other ice ages like this one where temperature was lower. We know of five of them going back more than 500 million years. The last one lasted 100 million years. It was called the Karoo with a capital K-A-R-O-O. So we have basically entered a period where science is being abolished in place of political sloganeering, narratives, storytelling, fairy tales, and scary stories about the future, all of which, as my book points out, are based on invisible or remote factors which cannot be tested or observed by the general public, and therefore the politicians can pay the scientists to make up any scare story they want with our money, all the money going to these climate scientists is pretty much public money. You don't see 3M or DuPont or Ford financing this stuff to make things better. They're just making scare stories. That's their whole purpose in life. And then, of course, the politicians use those scare stories to get votes. And then the media uses those scare stories to get viewers because of sensationalism. And the activists use the so-called environmental activists that hijack the environmental movement when the political left realized that there was money in it. And all those people are making hundreds of millions of dollars based on BS and calling it science. So that was a bit long-winded, but that's my interpretation of the present situation.
All right, we're going to put the polar bears on hold for a minute because I want to pursue this line. I think, like most people, up until quite recently, it never occurred to me that there might be something fundamentally rotten about the scientific establishment per se. And again, I truly believe if there were no state involvement, because as you say, Ford isn't investing in any of this, we would have far less of this craziness. But now, and the thing is, it's very hard to say this because the scientific establishment is where the current day priesthood is to be found. These people are working for our welfare. They're employing abstract reason to investigate important questions using fact-based methods, and anybody who questions them must be a superstitious idiot. But there's a certain superstition surrounding this establishment. In the social sciences, in economics, it's very interesting to note that the Federal Reserve is actually a controversial institution. It's not simply cut and dry that it's a great institution that brings us economic stability. There's a lot of literature arguing to the contrary. But when you look at the percentage of the profession that gets subsidized in one way or another from the Fed, whether it's conferences or grants or this and that or prestige, it's overwhelming. It's the vast majority of them. And so it's not necessarily that they all actively think to themselves, well, I'm on the Fed's payroll, so I better make sure and say that it's the best thing. It's that people tend to conflate in their minds that what's best for them is probably also what's best for the country and mankind. And so whether actively, deliberately doing it or whether just subconsciously, they wind up being shills for a particular cause. And it seems to me like this may also be happening in some areas of science because scientists are no less political. Why would a scientist be less political than you and me? Do they come from another species? Are they from a different planet? So can you talk about that aspect of the question?
Well, it's been many years now, perhaps 20 years or even 25, where as a scientist, if you are looking at earth science, at the life sciences and the earth sciences, if you don't put something about climate change in your proposal, if you're seeking public funding, which is where most of it comes from these days, you're not going to get your grant. You have to have something about climate change in your application. And then you've got the fact that the science journals have been taken over by journalists, whereas they were once actually run by scientists. The journalists are looking for volume in their readership. So they're looking for sensation too. It's a giant circle jerk, Tom. There's other words for it that are not quite so clean, but it is basically a feeding frenzy in among all these people. And the four categories that I mentioned was one less than we need to mention, and that is crony capitalists are also in there. So they are business that is sucking money out of the public purse, and wind and solar are the biggest problem there. Because it's become so that, you know, when they suck all this money out of the public purse for the wind and solar as subsidies, mandates, and tax credits, then they've got a very powerful machine to lobby the deep state or whatever you want to call that cabal in the bureaucracy and government that is influenced by the lobbyists. you've got a big lobby to continue with that. And, I mean, wind and solar should have been dead long ago. I mean, they don't perform well at all. They're not even there. They're more than 50%, there's nothing there. And it's like actually more than 60, 70% in most cases. There's nothing there. And you have to wait for it to happen, wait for the sun to come out or wait for the wind to blow. Whereas the other energy technologies, coal, gas, nuclear, and hydroelectric, are generally 24/7. And they don't get subsidized. Whereas the subsidies are going to this phony wind and solar scheme that is being sold as renewable, when in fact the entire thing is being constructed by fossil fuel technology in the mining of the minerals and the transport of all the parts and manufacturing and construction and everything else is run by fossil fuels. So I have long ago postulated that we should make a rule that all the wind and solar technology from beginning to end should be powered by wind and solar. And I don't think they'd be able to produce themselves. In other words, I think they're a negative in most cases and are in fact a parasite on the larger economy. That's my analysis of those two things. And they are much bigger than the research going into climate change. They are, in fact, trillions as opposed to the billions which are going into the fake science that is, for some reason, able to be used to defend energy technologies that don't work most of the time.
I think what started leading me down this road, and then after I make this point, I do want to go talk polar bears. I have a bunch of topics from your book I want to get into. But
You got to do polar bears, yeah.
Yeah, no, of course. Because, of course, by emphasizing that, they're appealing to people's sensibilities. They're appealing to people's emotions. So we'll get to that in a minute. And I don't want to drag you into this conversation because I don't know where you stood on the COVID lockdowns and all that. And I don't want to start that up. But observing the way the public health establishment in this country and in a lot of places around the world handled the COVID situation is what has now thrown everything into doubt for me. That now I have to assume politics has invaded everything. Because what seems to have happened was a vast overconfidence in what they could model and what seems to me an intoxication that has occurred in terms of the feelings that they seem to get from having the kind of power that they suddenly have. I mean, normally, nobody pays any attention to anybody in public health, ever. Now, suddenly, we're having daily briefings with these people telling us where we should go and that in Los Angeles, you can go to a drive-in movie. Thank you for the permission, but you can't have a double feature. I mean, what course in public health told them you couldn't have a double feature at a drive-in movie? It's all arbitrary craziness, but at least some of it is driven simply by the libido dominandi, but by people who just love to tell people they consider to be stupid peons anyway what to do. They consider these peons to be the reason that the world is polluted and they don't like our habits and what they despise cars, they despise everything, they despise our lifestyles, the way we think, what we believe. And to be able to lord it over us is just too much for them to resist. And I don't believe it's largely driven by public health. But the very fact that you can't get an answer out of them as to why is Florida doing so well? Why is it number 41 in age-adjusted COVID mortality? When it has been thumbing its nose at you people, you can't get a straight answer out of them. The whole thing has been a joke. And now it's made me wonder, because the analogies with climate change seem to be, which I have forsworn to discuss, seem to be so strong with, again, an overconfidence in what we can model, but an absolute, regardless of any competing arguments, an absolute determination to carry forward anyway, to spell out doom if we don't obey them, to hold out the prospects of lockdowns, the comparison seems to be rather apt.
Yeah, well, never mind the fact that it's still being more or less denied that this is part of Chinese biological warfare research that was being supported by the United States in the same way that Canada is bringing Chinese soldiers over here to train them in cold weather combat. Oh, that's going to be really great for us in the future that the Chinese know how to come over to the cold country and combat us. So we're shooting ourselves in the head, never mind the foot. But this comes back to what you said. This is about tyranny. This is about power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's a slogan I've long adhered to. And that's why monopolies are so dangerous. Because once you have a monopoly, the whole psychology changes and you become all powerful. And when people become all powerful, they become tyrannical. And so we must have a system, and this is why the U.S. Constitution is such a wonderful document. And many people are pointing that out now. The checks and balances and the provisions of the U.S. Constitution recognize that, and the antitrust legislation recognizes that monopolies are tyrannical by nature. It doesn't matter who the people are. These could be very nice people if they didn't have a monopoly. So I agree with you that the parallels between the climate change and COVID situations are real, and it has to do with human psychology. And unless we get a handle on this, we will sink into a morass of tyranny. But, you know, you mentioned that these could otherwise be nice people, and that is true. But why is it that the people who say there's too many people don't go first? I've always wondered about that. It's because they think they are the chosen ones, that they are a superior class of people because they're so smart to realize there's too many people, and therefore it shouldn't be them that have to disappear. I mean, it would be very simple for all the people who admit that they think there's too many people to take a pill. It would be painless. And then the nicest thing about that is that the people who are left behind would not think there were too damn many people and would be happy about the fact that they were all the people were there, instead of complaining about humans being the enemies of nature and the destroyers of the earth. The people would live in harmony with the greenery and the energy flows of this planet, and would also support nuclear energy, because I have a feeling the people who think there's too many people are the people who are against nuclear energy. They're the people who support massive subsidies for wind and solar. They're the people who want me gone from the face of the earth, even though I am living a perfectly suitable life, traveling about, speaking, and being a constructive member of society. But I don't want to be a tyrant. I have absolutely no feelings in that regard. I just want to be a contributor to the collective wisdom of the science. And nobody's countering anything I'm saying in my new book. It's only 200 pages and is full of material which debunks almost all of the scare stories that are being bandied about today. There's a few of them that I didn't put in there, but I could have. And every single one of them is because they are either caused by something invisible, like carbon dioxide, radiation, and the fake thing that's in GMOs, which doesn't exist, because if it did, it would have a name, and everything has a name, so therefore it doesn't exist. But radiation and CO2 do exist, it's just that they're invisible, so people can't actually see what they're doing. And then there's the polar bears and the coral reefs, which have finally emerged, all in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which has finally emerged as the iconic symbols of ecological destruction and its mass extinction and all the rest. It just so happens that polar bears and coral reefs in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch are not within view of the general public, and only seen by a very few people who are lucky enough to get grants to go out and study them, etc., and some rich tourists who get to go and see a few polar bears or a small part of the Great Barrier Reef. So all of these scare stories are based on things that the average person can't observe or verify or replicate in any way, which is basically the scientific method. They're not able to apply the scientific method to their knowledge of these issues, and therefore they are prey to the bureaucrats, scientists, politicians, media, and activists raising billions of dollars on the basis of false scare stories.
Well, I'll just say that maybe I myself might have fallen for the Great Pacific Garbage Patch story, because I would have just looked at it and thought, well, unfortunately, when you have a giant unowned resource like an ocean, there's a possibility that people could abuse it. I might have just thought of it that way and then just moved on. But I have your book and I have the evidence that you have, but not a lot of people do. They just rely on photographs they see. And it turns out the photograph that they see isn't even of the thing being discussed. But look, since I've teased people on the polar bears for so darn long in this episode, let's get back to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Let's go. So what exactly is the story with the polar bears? They're doing fine.
The most ironic thing about the polar bear, I'll lead with this, is that if it were not for climate change, there would be no polar bears. That's the irony. Because there once was a North Pole with no ice on it, up until this Pleistocene ice age came to be 2.6 million years ago, which is a blink in geological time, there were only the European brown bear. The European brown bear was confined to the old world. 15,000 years ago, it came to the new world over the Bering Land Bridge and became the grizzly bear. So they are the same species, the grizzly bear and the European brown bear. But back when the polar bear came into being, there were no grizzly bears. There was only the European brown bear, mostly in northern Russia and Scandinavia. And they're largely open country animals. And when the North Pole froze and the Arctic Ocean started to freeze over, it was possible for a bear to walk on the ice. And there were seals breeding under the ice and making holes to breed, which could be hunted by a bear. So brown bears migrated northward, and then they separated, the brown ones staying to the south because they were always there. But the ones that went north turned into polar bears over a period of a few hundred thousand years during the 40-odd major glaciations that have occurred and the interglacial periods that were in between them over the last 2.6 million years, which is the International Commission on Stratigraphy, or Stratigraphy, decides when these demarcations are. But it's a continuum. It's not like it all of a sudden is a giant change. But the North Pole gradually froze over. And so the only reason polar bears exist is because these brown bears went north, started hunting seals, eventually turned white because the camouflage is useful, and also developed a different dietary system, which is more carnivorous, the digestive system. So they are distinct from the European brown bear, but they're still so close, really related genetically, that they can interbreed with each other if they ever meet up, which doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And they can actually produce a successful offspring that can breed again. And this is actually the definition of a species. So in some senses, the grizzly bear and the polar bear are the same species, but they have differentiated enough that we're giving them separate Latin names. And that's the story of why there are polar bears, because of climate change. But coming to the future here, I mean the present, in 1973, the wildlife biologists studying the polar bears went to the leaders of the polar countries, Russia, Canada, the United States, Greenland, which is Denmark, and Norway, and said the polar bears are endangered because of overhunting. It had now become easy to fly to the Arctic, hire an Inuit guide, and get a couple of polar bear rugs or more to bring back home for the fireplace. So the northern countries looked at this and very quickly, in fact, after getting this advice, formed a committee and created an international treaty that was signed in 1973 to end the unrestricted hunting of polar bears. There was no restrictions at all, no limit, no nothing. That's why they were being decimated. And nobody is told this today. The media never tells, the politicians never tell, the activists never tell people about this treaty. Because this treaty resulted in an end to the slaughter of polar bears, which are only now killed very seldom, mostly by Inuit people themselves. So they have grown from about 8,000 in 1973 to somewhere between 30 and 50,000 today, and yet they are used as an icon of mass extinction of species in the world. It's completely backwards. Those counts are true. So now what they say is, oh yes, there may be more of them now than there were back then, but they're going to be extinct by 2100 because of climate change. So they just keep pushing it into the future. They even admit that there's 30 to 50,000, which is in a way why you don't hear as much about polar bears now, because myself and a couple of other people, it only took a couple of other people to blow this out of the water. And then on top of that, you have the Inuit people who live in Nunavut in Canada. They are the most largest population of Inuit people in the Arctic Circle region. They have a council in Iqaluit, which is the capital of Nunavut, on the south end of it, Baffin Island. Just 2 years ago, they passed a law to create a polar bear management program. Because there's too many polar bears, and they're coming into the villages and ransacking the place and even killing people. So they don't want to go to the funerals of any of their friends and family killed by polar bears anymore. So they've created a management plan that gives them the right, which they did not have before, to defend themselves from polar bears. The fact that that passed in a legislature in Canada by a government body was not reported in any Canadian or American newspaper or any other newspaper except one, a tiny newspaper in Nunavut in a town of 1,200 people. They're the only ones that were told about that legislation being passed in the same way as no one was told about the 1973 treaty to end the unrestricted hunting of polar bears. And that's my polar bear story, and I'm sticking to it. And anybody who thinks they can counter it, good luck.
Oh, wow. Was the polar bear story spread by reputable, you know, in quotation marks, people? Or was this just a popularized kind of story that the experts never truly believed? I mean, what was the origin of it?
A group of experts called the Polar Bear Something Group, which is a consensus group. In other words, if you don't agree with the consensus, you're out of the polar bear group, then you won't get any funding to go back there again, probably, and that sort of thing. And in addition, the environmental groups, the NGOs, as they call themselves, the environmental groups were basically hijacked by the political left years and years ago. That's why I left Greenpeace in 1986. It started to happen there early on, too. When we showed, demonstrated that the environmental movement could be fairly lucrative from a financial point of view and fairly successful from a political point of view, we got hijacked by politicals. We weren't politicals so much. Most of us in Greenpeace were environmentalists, naturalists, lovers of life, not haters of people. We were quite humanitarian. We started with a campaign against nuclear weapons and nuclear war and nuclear weapons testing. That's how Greenpeace started. That means we were trying to save civilization from all-out nuclear war. So we actually cared about people. That's the peace in Greenpeace. But as time went on, the peace was kind of dropped, and all there was left was the green, and then the movement started characterizing humans as the enemies of the Earth, as if we were the only evil species on the planet. Like, that's way too much like original sin for me. Like, all of the other species, including the diseases and the vermin and the cancers, you know, the viruses, those are all fine. Only humans are evil. And that is like original sin in religion. So I just don't buy that. Because humans are part of nature. We evolved with the rest of nature. We human beings survived through all these billions of years. Our ancestors survived. What most people don't understand is that every single living thing on Earth today, every individual of every tree, every insect, every human, every fish, every everything, represents a continuous, successful reproduction since the beginning of life. That is 3.5 billion years. If they hadn't succeeded in reproducing, their line is lost. That's like the pruning of the evolutionary shrub. We are the leaves of that evolutionary shrub that have sprouted today after coming through the entire gamut of all the mass extinctions, the five great mass extinctions that occurred, and they were really mass extinctions that took out 95% of all species, like the Permian extinction 250 million years ago, and the dinosaur extinction, as it's called, took out a lot more than dinosaurs, took out the majority of species at the time. And we represent, our ancestors obviously lived through those extinction events. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And so this is a really important thing to understand, because we belong here just as much as any of the other species that managed to make it through all that, which includes all 1.7 odd million species that exist in the world today, survived through all of that cataclysm and ice ages and hot periods and cold periods and all the rest of it. So there you go. That's my thesis, and I'm sticking to that.
Okay, fair enough. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to say a word about one of my favorite things in the world, the Happily Date Box. A lot of folks are in great relationships, but their schedules are so tight and they're running around and everything's hectic, and they never really get around to those romantic getaways that they know they need. They're never really able to carve out that quality time together that is essential to that relationship. Conversely, you can have people in relationships where they're constantly doing things together, but they'd like to have something fun that they can do quietly at home from time to time. And the Happily Date Box is just what the doctor ordered in both cases. We absolutely love it. Every month, Happily sends us a themed box containing activities, conversation starters, a music playlist that bring us closer together. And the theme could be the 1980s, or France, or Greece, or game shows, or whatever. And inside, you'll find games, crafts, all kinds of activities you could not have thought up yourself. And the result is a wonderful evening together that brings you closer. And men, if you think of this without having to be prompted by her, you will be a hero. Well, take 50% off your first date when you go to tomwoods.com/date. That's 50% off your first date. So men, no excuse not to try this at tomwoods.com/date. Let's push forward to something that I didn't really know much about until I read your chapter, and that is that Great Pacific Garbage Patch story. Now, I'm on page 103 of your book.
Oh, yeah.
And you say, for many years, the story of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch has been publicized as a great environmental tragedy. It is described as three times the size of France and twice the size of Texas. The web is full of images that give the impression that the Central Pacific Ocean is completely covered in floating garbage, most of which is plastic. And then you quote a CNN story saying, according to a three-year study published in Scientific Reports Friday, the mass known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is about 1.6 million square kilometers in size, up to 16 times bigger than previous estimates. That makes it more than double the size of Texas. And then immediately on the next page, we have a photograph. And in the photograph, you say, images like this one are often used to depict the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. But this image is from the aftermath of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami in 2011 and swept entire towns and villages into the sea. This photo was clearly not taken in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, as there is land a short distance away in the background. And you can see it right there in the picture. So can this possibly be a hoax? What's the story?
It's not possibly a hoax, Tom. It is entirely 100% a hoax. If you look on the internet, if you Google Great Pacific Garbage Patch, place the size of Texas or whatever, all you find mostly is images of the Pacific Ocean with photoshopped blobs on there with an arrow pointing saying Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It isn't a real thing. It's fake. And then you also see this photo that you just described, which if you see underneath it, there is a cut line saying that it's part of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, when in fact it is the result of the tsunami in Japan washing towns and villages into the sea, which is long dispersed. A lot of it floated across the Pacific. Some of it got caught in the gyre, but a lot of it floated up. I'm from Vancouver Island. A lot of it ended up on our beaches. But it wasn't a huge problem. It was just a bunch of junk washing up on the beaches. You see, the thing about plastic that's really weird is that we use it to wrap all our food, most of our food. We wrap all our stuff in plastic film, and we put our stuff in plastic containers, and that's because plastic is inert and sterile and non-toxic and clean. It's easy to clean. It doesn't shed anything into our food. Whereas when it goes in the ocean, apparently it becomes a deadly toxin that is killing the fish and the tiny organisms. And when you go into the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and when I show this photograph, which is from a German satellite, a European satellite, which shows a composite of the Pacific Ocean cloudless, because there's clouds everywhere some days, but they take these pictures over a year period. During that time, that everywhere has no cloud at one time or other, so they make a composite of it. So you can see the North Pacific Ocean cloudless. It's easy to see the Hawaiian Islands. They are not twice the size of Texas, but there is no Pacific Garbage Patch in that photograph. So when confronted with this, people in audiences often come up to me and say, yeah, but. And what one guy said was, yeah, but it's all the clear plastic. That's why you can't see it. As if the clear plastic knows how to congregate in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and all the colored plastic stays away. So that's not terribly credible. Then the next thing they say is it's just under the surface. That's why you can't see it. As if every piece of plastic has like a buoyancy compensation device on it, or the density of the water versus the density of the plastic. No, that is not the case. Plastic usually either floats or sinks. A very small part of that ends up somewhere in the water column, but not just near the surface. So, okay, that is debunked. Now they say, oh, but it's actually microplastic in the water column. Oh, I say, you mean it's invisible? And that's the truth of what they say. They say it's microplastic. Microplastic means it's invisible and it's so small. Then they say it's getting stuck in the fish's livers or something and building up in there and it's going to kill them. it's just a complete hoax, the whole thing. There's nothing about it that is real. The fact of the matter is, a piece of plastic floating in the ocean is no different than a piece of wood floating in the ocean, except plastic is in different shapes, sometimes in the shape of something that can be used as a shelter or habitat by marine creatures, whereas wood is not usually in the shape of a bottle or a cup or something like that that could be used as shelter. In addition to that, plastic is being used by seabirds as a dietary aid for digestion. Yet Sir David Attenborough is claiming that the albatross are feeding plastic to their chicks, mistaking it for food. No, they're not. They're feeding bits of plastic to their chicks just the same way as they feed bits of pumice, bits of wood, and nuts, which are hard, and the squid beaks, because when the albatross feeds a squid to the young chick in the nest, it keeps the beak in its gizzard. You see, birds don't have teeth, so they can't chew their food. So they have a second stomach, which is muscular, in which all their lives birds have to collect pebbles if they're land birds. But pebbles don't float in the ocean very well. So they take what they can get that is floating in the ocean. And for the last 40, 50 years, there's been hard bits of plastic floating in the ocean that are just the right size for using in the gizzard as a digestive aid. And Attenborough, who wrote The Secret Life of Birds and had a 10-part BBC series on birds, apparently doesn't know that birds have gizzards and that the reason the albatross are feeding hard bits of plastic to their chicks is to aid with digestion, not as food. So there you go.
I'm just flabbergasted at this particular one, even though it's not the most consequential one of the topics in your book. It is the most grotesque in a way because of the photos of things that aren't even what is claimed in the allegation, that there's this giant big pile of garbage. And of course, the implication is, well, what's the implication? Well, if you leave human beings to their own devices, look what they go and do. So therefore, we need another global panel to figure out this and that. Now, again, when you have an unowned thing like the ocean, it's not clear exactly what kind of political regime you need to have in order to keep an eye on it. But the point is, this thing did not occur. It did not occur. And I think people probably reading articles, watching television, going to museums, walked away with the idea that it was happening and that people who were not part of the environmental movement were simply obstructionists who just couldn't even be bothered to care about the simplest matters of the welfare of the planet. So it's amazing to me that it occurred. But I'm going to ask your indulgence on something. I said we wouldn't discuss climate change, but I mean that in the sense of getting into the extent to which there's warming and what's causing it and what are the consequences of that. I've done that quite a few times on the show. But I do want to discuss it in this sense with one more topic, and then I'll let you go. Because what we are getting these days is climate change is causing A, B, C, and D and all these allegedly related things. So extreme weather events, always climate change. COVID-19, well, climate change is going to give us more pandemics. I'm sure you saw that being claimed by some people. And in your book, you have a chapter on forest fires, and forest fires are being blamed on climate change. Let's talk specifically about forest fires. But there is this larger problem whereby whatever disaster we encounter is automatically being attributed to climate change. And if you say, well, that seems awfully convenient that every emergency we have just happens to feed into your political narrative, that's amazing. And anybody who bothers to point that out is, of course, a terrible person who shouldn't be listened to.
Yes, well, they might as well say it's all caused by witches or that it's all caused by God because God is bad and is doing these things to us. Or the devil, of course, who's the opposite of God, could be doing it all. But it's all made up and totally fictitious in the long run. As you can see, I'm not a particularly religious person. I do respect why people have religion, and as long as they're not using it to harm people, I'm perfectly happy to let them continue with their beliefs. But if you believe that climate change causes everything, you know that it's a religion. You know, I mean, nothing causes everything except for God, and maybe nature, with a capital N, could be used. But the idea of using extreme weather events and fire, which could be seen as an extreme, not really weather event, but an extreme event that, you know, that kills people. These extreme events are not all caused by climate change, because climate change is actually a global phenomenon. Climate change is not a local phenomenon. Weather is a local phenomenon. So the idea of conflating climate change with extreme weather is flawed fundamentally in its origins. It used to be that they did not say that extreme weather events. They said, no, that's just weather. That's not climate. Then they suddenly shifted because the climate stopped changing for about 20 years. In other words, the temperature stopped changing for about 20 years between about 1996 and 2014 or whatever it was. There was no actual change. It was up and down, but it ended up in the same place it started. And so they had to invent something new, and they decided to now call extreme weather events part of climate change. But, like, for example, this big heat wave that hit the Pacific Northwest, I was in it. It didn't kill me, but it can kill older people who don't have air conditioning and can't breathe properly. I mean, it's a fact that heat can kill people, but 20 times as many people are killed by cold every year as are killed by heat. That's because we're actually in a cold period now. Take note that ice covers large areas of the North and South Pole. And ice is the enemy of life. And yet they talk about ice as if it's like alive or something. They kill the glacier. You know, no, the glacier is preventing a forest from growing on the ground underneath it. That would be a better thing to have there than a glacier, no doubt about it. Although the ice for the polar bears is an issue. But then again, they've only been around for about 300,000 years, and the only reason they're around is because of the ice age forming ice over the North Pole. Climate could change again. So conflating local weather events with climate change is fundamentally wrong from the start. Climate change is a global phenomenon. The warming of the Earth or the cooling of the Earth, those are global. The Earth is a global thing, not an extreme weather event. So we've had extreme weather events since the beginning of time. Some of them are deadly. Many of them are undesirable. It's blowing too hard. It's raining too much. It's not raining enough. The tornado tore the city to shreds. It's funny, the United States has 90% of all the tornadoes in the world, just because of the topographic shape of the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains cause the air patterns to be such as to form these things. And so it's nothing to do with climate change, tornadoes, etc., or hurricanes. Well, actually, hurricanes do have something to do with climate change in that the warmer the world gets, the fewer and less powerful hurricanes will be, because hurricanes are based largely on the difference in temperature between the tropics and the pole, or the temperate region primarily, the northern and southern regimes. And in the south, it's the same between the southern and northern, or the northern and the equatorial. And it's the difference in temperature of air masses that causes these. And that's because why they are in the season they're in, as the air warms up in the summer. Everybody in meteorology knows this. So I would say, to begin with, the whole thing is bunk. It's colder now, and there's less CO2 now than there should be. Let's make one point about CO2. When we burn fossil fuels, we are releasing the carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, which the trees used to make themselves and turned into coal. And the ocean animals, the marine animals, and plants used to make themselves and turn into marine sediments and turn into oil and gas. Most of the oil and gas is from marine sediments. And even when oil and gas is found on land, for example, in Texas all the way north to Alberta, that was a sea bottom at one time. Those are marine sediments. The tectonic plates of the Earth move around in mysterious ways. And the fact is, all the coal is from forests made of wood. Wood is 50% carbon. That carbon came from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by photosynthetic conversion into wood in the tree. And then the tree turned into coal. So all we're doing when we burn fossil fuels is replenishing the CO2 that used to be in the cycle between the plants and the ocean and the air. The ocean absorbs CO2 from the atmosphere, and the creatures in the ocean live on that CO2. The plankton in the ocean, the basis of the food chain, is living on CO2. And the plants on the land are living on CO2. That's why the Earth is greening due to our increase in CO2. CO2, and ironically, China and India are contributing more to the greening of the earth than all the other countries put together, because they're emitting more CO2 than all the other countries put together, and they're planting vast new areas of forest and croplands to feed their billions of people in order to keep them alive. And so this is the biggest part of the carbon cycle is in China and India and South Asia, if you combine that whole thing, is way more than all the rest of the world put together. So we're replenishing the carbon dioxide. We're not poisoning the atmosphere. It used to be there. That same carbon used to be carbon dioxide in the atmosphere before it was turned into fossil fuels. And then there's the carbonaceous rocks, which I'll save for another feature. But most of the carbon that was removed from the atmosphere and the oceans turned into limestone, calcium carbonate, by the marine creatures that learned to make armor plating out of limestone, calcium carbonate, by combining carbon dioxide in the ocean with calcium. And that sank to the bottom because it's a heavy shell and turned into marine sediment, which we now make into cement. And so about 5% of our CO2 emissions are from cement production, turning calcium carbonate into lime and CO2, and 95% are from fossil fuels, which are far less abundant sediment than the limestone, which is like 10,000 times more carbon was lost to limestone deposits than was lost to fossil fuel deposits.
Let me just circle back to the forest fire thing just for a second, because when we see forest fires, we sometimes get up arguments about government policy, that the government is responsible for the forest fire problem because of it's doing this or it's not doing this, or other people say it's the private sector responsible for the forest fire problem because it's not doing this. And then we have this white noise of climate change is driving forest fires. Can you just sort that out so the ordinary person can get it?
Yeah, well, first, forest fires have been happening since forests began over 300 million years ago. So it's nothing new. And it was usually lightning that caused these fires. But as time went on, humans invented other ways to cause forest fires, such as campfires not being put out, cigarette butts being thrown away, arsonists came into the picture, and power lines, like the PG&E power line that burned down paradise in California, was because they weren't clearing the trees away from the power line. You shouldn't have a power line in the coniferous forest, or any forest that for that matter, where a tree is close enough to fall onto it and cause a conflagration such as occurred there. But more importantly, the responsibility for the problem we have today in California in particular, and the West in general, is that urban greens have gained control of policy over forest management, and they know nothing about forest ecology or biology or forests or whatever. When in fact, the Aborigines of Australia, who came there 60,000 years ago, and the Native Americans who came here 15,000 years ago, soon learned that the solution to preventing hot, raging wildfires in the midsummer was to do controlled burns in the spring when it's still cooler, when there's no wind in the air, and when the moisture is still in the ground. And this way you just burn off the dead stuff. And by burning off the dead stuff, you prevent the crown fires that occur in coniferous trees. You prevent the grass fires from all the dead grass from last year. And so this is what they learned. And even the urban greens don't seem to be able to muster up the knowledge about this. And they have now created a situation where forest fires are increasing. Now, the U.S. Forest Service denied the vast areas that were burnt in the United States before people occupied all of it, before, say, 1940. They have said they don't believe that information anymore. It's their information, for Pete's sake. They're the ones who collected it. And now, because it shows so much higher areas of forest being burned, well, before we understood how to control forest fires, they have basically abolished that data from their website and everything, as if it doesn't exist, when they're the ones who collected it. And it's very, very obvious that they wouldn't overestimate the amount of forest area being burned. If anything, they would underestimate it. But today, we have a situation where the town of Paradise was built into a coniferous forest. And if you look at the photograph in my book of the aftermath of that fire, you will see exactly what I'm talking about. You should never build communities in coniferous forests. As a matter of fact, we should never build communities in heavily dense forests with a bunch of deadwood on the ground, which is what they did there. You should first cut nearly all the coniferous trees and make wooden paper out of them. And you should leave a few iconic ones, single trees here and there. Then you should plant broadleaf trees like maples and oaks and all the others, tilapias and oh, there's so many beautiful leaf trees, in other words, what I mean, angiosperms, the flowering trees. You should plant those because they're not pitchy like the conifers are. And you should just plant them in small clumps, and then you should have lots of grass and open ground so the fire can't go across that. And you should make sure the dead wood is removed from the forest on a regular basis every 3, 4, 5 years, and then you won't have these catastrophic fires. So it's all because of ignorance and human misunderstanding of forest ecology and lack of respecting the original people's knowledge of how to deal with this and not have their whole village burned down in the summer, because, and they didn't have the machinery we have to do this work. They had to do everything by hand. So there's my story about forest fires. Oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
In order to manage the forest properly, you need money. They have basically eliminated all logging in the western United States practically, unless it's on private land, and most of the United States West is in various forms of public ownership in huge national parks and national forests and year of land management. Idaho is 70% federally owned, for example. And so the government in Washington, where there's more politicians from the East than there are from the West, the Eastern politicians can vote in anything they want to lock up land in the West, and it doesn't affect their electorate. And that's one of the big problems, structural problems in the United States land management that I have just described. But if they would allow some forestry, friendly forestry, ecologically based forestry, that is where you cut trees down and make them into things, in the West, then they would have the funds, as long as they let private enterprise do it, because if the government did it, it would cost more than they got back. But if you let the private enterprise do it under government rules, do proper forestry and make money, and use that money to manage the forest to prevent these kind of wildfires, you'd have a better world.
Well, on that, we're going to wrap things up, and I will urge people to check out, I just love the title of the book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, by our guest Patrick Moore. I'm linking to it on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1937. You're doing heroic work, Patrick, and helping people understand what's really going on, and we're very grateful. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure being with you. I'd like to come on again someday.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. Busy week ahead for me, because I'm preparing for Mises University next week at the Mises Institute, and then for Freedom Fest later that week in South Dakota, where I'm doing several panels. It's a lot of fun, but a lot of preparation. So I'm going to be working on that this week. I hope to see you at the very least at Freedom Fest, those of you who are able to make it to South Dakota. I know we're going to have a lot of fun there, so I look forward to meeting some of you, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.